Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. Have with me today in the studio for University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Ronald Sultana. Professor Sultana is Professor of Educational Sociology and Comparative Education here at the University of Malta, where he directs the Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research, with the acronym EMSA. He's the founding editor of the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies and has studied education in Malta, the UK, New Zealand and the USA, where he was Fulbright Scholar at Stanford University. He has published 25 volumes, no less, and over 100 articles and chapters in referee journals and books. Most of his work relates to the linkages between education, development and the world of work, and focuses on issues of equity and social justice. His research has taken him to several countries in the Mediterranean region and Europe, and he has been involved in projects with such entities as UNESCO, UNICEF, GIZ, the ILO, the Commonwealth Secretariat, and the European Union. Welcome to the programme, Professor Sultana.
Thank you.
I know that you'd like to talk about a couple of very interesting projects that you're working on at the moment, but perhaps we could start off by talking a little bit about your Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research, something about its objectives and some of the main things that you try to achieve within the centre.
First of all, thank you very much for having me, and it's a pleasure to talk about some of the work we're doing. The Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research actually focuses on educational challenges that we have to face in our region. These have evolved over time, of course. At the moment, there's a lot of interest in how education can sustain democracies, for example. But there are a number of other equally important challenges across the whole region, starting from the links between education and the economy. How can education promote economic development, for example? What is the role of education in the formula for economic success? There's the formation of teachers in order to ensure that our schools in the region perform as well as in other regions in the world. One could focus, for example, on the importance of parental involvement in schools and how education can open its doors in order to involve adults and turning schools into learning communities. So there's a number of very interesting challenges and issues that need to be faced in our region. What we have done, perhaps, which is unique, is that we have created a space for these issues to be discussed. And we have done this in a number of ways. Obviously, we have the journal. It's the only journal that focuses on education in the Mediterranean region. It's created, in a sense, a lens through which to look at what's happening in our region in terms of educational development. But we also do other stuff. I mean, one of the very successful things we've managed to do with our center is to offer a master's in comparative education. Now, in its fifth running, we have the fifth cohort of students just starting this semester, where students study at master's level a number of different challenges for education in the region. They do a quite extensive research project, often comparative in nature, looking, for example, at Malta and Cyprus, or Malta and Sicily, and looking at a range of areas like language teaching.
I was reading through what you do with this MA in Comparative Euro-Mediterranean Education Studies. You welcome graduates from education, obviously, people with good degrees in education,
right.
But you're also interested in students from other areas.
Absolutely.
Because perhaps this is a subject that can be taken up by Sociologists, perhaps. Or
absolutely, yes. In fact, some of our very good students have come from other areas, including anthropology. For example, we have a Greek student whose first degree is anthropology. She is doing a very interesting piece of work on how the Scouts movement in Greece and in Malta has provided a context for informal education. We've had an American student who also joined the course with a background which was, I believe, in linguistics. So we have a number of different profiles of students, and they really add something to the course. I really believe in a rich background. Education is a vast area which is interdisciplinary by its very nature. If you're an economics student, for example, or you've got a legal background, you're most welcome to this course. And you actually bring to the, it's a course based on readings, which we discuss. So it's not lecturing, but it's quite intensive reading, which is followed up by critical discussions of texts, where people bring in their different perspectives. So having people from with different backgrounds, disciplinary backgrounds, is absolutely crucial and something to be commended.
Obviously, you have some Maltese students, I presume, and you also encourage international students
as
well.
Yes, I mean, we've had somebody from Germany who did a very interesting study on quality of higher education and the impact of the European higher education area, particularly on Egypt and Israel. So they come with different backgrounds. And it's an enrichment to the course because they also bring with them different traditions of how to be a postgraduate student. Germans are not the same as the Americans, as they are not the same as the Greeks, and obviously not the same as Maltese. So I find that this is not only interesting in itself, but also has an impact on the pedagogy we use and on the level of discussions that we have.
So you're not only actually learning about comparative education, but you're actually living it within the course itself.
Exactly, exactly, because they will bring with them different experiences of quite different educational traditions, and that's, I think, an enrichment.
And when you do your research for the center, clearly you don't remain here, you go out, and I was looking at some of the places that you've been to,
right?
And they're very diverse,
right?
So the comparisons must be incredibly interesting. You look south, north, west, east, there must be so much going on, so many different things to look at. It must be quite overwhelming.
A lot of my research has tended to focus on a particular educational innovation. Just to mention a few, for example, in Egypt, I looked very closely at the way girls who are usually married off at the age of 12 are there's a project spearheaded by UNICEF in order to keep girls in schools. So my job was actually to go to these rather remote places in Egypt, taken there by four-wheel drive vehicles, often accompanied, meeting with the imam of a village, getting an introduction to the community, going to these what we call girl-friendly schools, interviewing the girls and observing the teaching that is going on, meeting with their parents, and trying to see why this innovation is working. And to capture this in a book form, which is accompanied by photographs. I often have photographers with me, who then we then translate this into Arabic and is distributed in the Arab region in order to learn from such an innovation. So that is a typical research that I do. This was took place in Egypt, but I've had similar ones in Palestine when I looked at how kids who are excluded from school because of the of a conflict situation. This was during the second intifada, where there was a curfew on, where kids could not go to school, and yet the Palestinian population in Hebron actually organized distance education, which where they produced, they transformed the curriculum into worksheets, and they trained parents and elder siblings to teach the younger kids. So they did not lose out on schooling. So that's a great experiment, very cheap in terms of actual costs, which is now being used internationally where there are conflict situations. And the third example is, let's say, Jordan, where Jordan among the Arab states is the one that is really promoting a lot early childhood education. And they've developed kindergartens, very much inspired by the Reggio Emilia model in Italy, but they gave it their own twist, actually embedded it in the culture that one would find in a number of communities in Jordan. And this is, early childhood education has not really taken root in the Arab states, partly because the families are very strong and the children are cared for by the extended family. So, and actually their model might be better than ours, because one could claim, why should I remove a child from the home in order to put it in a school? So there are some very interesting conversations to be had over there. But I documented their efforts to have kindergartens, and that was fascinating. So all of these are very specific, but within the context of a general linguistic, historic, cultural, economic background that is very similar in the Arab states. There are differences, but there's also lots of similarities. And I must say, it's fascinating. It's really a lot of fun, a lot of work, but also a lot of challenges to get you from your roots as a Maltese into a situation which is so culturally different, and yet so many resonances. I mean, I was brought up like most Maltese, thinking of myself as a European. And working in the Arab states, there are so many resonances with my childhood, smells, tiles on the floor in homes, way people behave, the nonverbal gestures that we use. And I discovered another me by going to these Arab states, which it was a really fascinating journey of identity, learning about myself as much as learning about others in many ways.
What about the actual practicalities? Because, of course, we know that it's not easy just to walk into Palestine or walk into any of these, Israel, particularly now, obviously, but even some years ago, not that easy. You have support, obviously, from people who have clout in the area, like UNICEF and this sort of thing. So these people give you the position to be able to go in. Is that the case?
That's exactly it. I mean, a lot of what I've done couldn't have been done on my own. You really need gatekeepers, and the gatekeepers in my case have largely been UNICEF. UNICEF is well regarded in many of these countries. Some other agencies are not. The World Bank, for example, I mean, they have a lot of clout, but are seen to be of a different sort of agency than, let's say, UNICEF. UNICEF has been very good to me in the sense that they did open up these opportunities. I could never, ever have entered Gaza without UNICEF. One of my projects was in Gaza. It was the fourth time I was trying to enter Gaza. Each time something happens and I had to return back to Jerusalem. It's very difficult to actually enter into Ramallah and stay there, as it was very difficult to enter Hebron where during the Second Intifada. Similarly, for example, another project was in Tunisia, where I had to work for a couple of weeks in the desert, in Kef and Kasserine, which borders on Algeria. I had never heard of these places. And you need UNICEF to get you to these places. You need UNICEF to provide the cultural baggage that you need. You need UNICEF and their people, who are often from the place, in order to get you access to homes, to guide you as to what to do and what not to do. I remember occasions where I was almost on the verge of doing the wrong thing. Like, for example, when I was doing research in the Palestinian camps in Lebanon, in Sabra and Shatila, for example, very famous camps. And I saw a lot of poverty, and I had a bundle of dollars, and I felt compelled to give charity. And my UNICEF colleague saw me about to do this and said, don't even
think about it.
Think about it. Because that is putting people down, giving charity. But I was compelled, you know, you see all that poverty and you're well off compared to them. And, you know, this is the way we've been raised. So a lot of these things, what to do, what not to do, shaking hands with women, for example, is something you don't do, where to sit, who to speak to first, all these. Besides, obviously, I don't speak Arabic. So you need an interpreter.
So cultural issues. But when it comes to the actual educational part, I mean, you are looking at what they are doing, but you're also bringing something with you. I suppose your experience from other places as well. How do you feel that the people you visit, do you find them normally open to hearing about other places, or what is the attitude when you go in, or has it been diverse?
I mean, two things come to my mind immediately. One is that being Maltese has been a great help, because you're not seen to be that different, but different enough to be acceptable. So a parting shot is often, I speak a little bit Maltese, which makes them roar with laughter, because they say, you call that Maltese, that's Arabic. So there's always that kind of banter going on. And that creates an incredible bond immediately. And I've seen classrooms which, while being less well-resourced than ours, better teaching was taking place, for example. So the second thing I've learned is also that I might have things to teach them, but I have a lot to learn from them. And I think in these kinds of countries, seeing a person who is genuinely interested, taking notes, praising people for their efforts, and actually saying, oh, I'll take this back to Malta with me as a good learning experience, makes them feel good. They hate, you know, these international consultants who come in suits with their briefcase, with ready-made solutions, without actually trying to understand, appreciate, and enter into their lives. So I've learned to do that, and that has been an amazing experience, learning a great deal and seeing how very often necessity is the mother of invention, we say, and how they actually respond to needs, even though sometimes their classes are packed with, you know, 40, 50, 60 kids. This is the case in Jordan, where I visited Palestinian schools, the schools for Palestinian refugees. And, I mean, these are apartments that have been rented out to them with 60 kids in the class, and the teacher struggling to not only teach, but also to teach in interactive ways with 60 kids, no less. So, yeah. I mean, amazing things.
The difficulties of teaching 60 small children, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. As time is rushing on, I'd love to go on chatting all morning, of course. Let's just talk a little bit about the two projects which you're particularly involved in at the moment. The first one, Teacher Education Reform in the Arab World. This is a Tempus project. Tempus would, I suppose, be a European funded project. And you and there's a leader, a university, I think you said the American University in Cairo.
That's correct.
And you are part of a group.
Right.
So tell us about the aims of this project.
Right. This is a very interesting project led by a person who was the UNICEF Education Program Director for all the Arab world. Brilliant lady, Malak Zaluk, who also started the community's school project in Egypt. And she's now professor at the American University in Cairo. And the project consists of conversations between teacher educators in the global south and in the global north. We fall somewhere in between. And it involves universities from Palestine, Egypt, and Lebanon, and then Malta, England, and Sweden. And we meet regularly to discuss and to analyze three aspects of teacher education. One is the practicum. How can we organize the field experiences so that teachers benefit from them as they are training to become teachers? The second one is continued professional development of teachers, and the third one is doing action research in schools in order to identify and address the challenges of pedagogy, of interactions within the school, of links to the community. So these are the three main areas. And we get together, we share, we've written case studies. There's a team from Malta that is involved in this. There's Michael Bohajar and Michelle Attartona in particular. And basically, we're writing up case studies of interesting practice. We're writing up handbooks. We're writing up examples of what we consider to be good practice and sharing these. This is extremely important. It has at least two crucial political dimensions. One is that the South has something to offer to the North. It's not just one-way traffic. So there's an interaction between global North and global South, where context matters, where we try to see how different educational actions unfold in different contexts. It's one thing to talk about Palestine and the West Bank, and another to talk about what's happening in Beirut. And the second important aspect of this is, of course, the sharing of experiences in such a way that drives the project forward at a particular point in time. We've all heard about the Arab Spring, and the Arab winter, perhaps we can call it, following the Arab Spring. there's a huge realization that democracy or forms of democracy can only take root if you put education into the equation. And teachers are particularly important in this task. Now, in the Arab world, I could almost generalize to say that there was one phase, particularly in the post-independence phase, where teachers were at the cutting edge of democracy. They were very strong trade union members. They were very strong leaders in democracy. They were the avant-garde in many cases. We are now in a different phase where a lot of the teachers have become conservative, where we really need to reach out to teachers in these countries in order to address the political issues of democracy that need to be discussed. So our work is also political in that sense. It has huge implications. So when we say action research, we're not just talking about a method of research. It's about being close to communities and getting in touch with communities rather than imposing an educational agenda. So there's a lot of that kind of work going on. It's a fascinating project. It will end next year. We're just on the verge of going to Beirut in a couple of weeks' time to go on with our next task.
So that is part of this would be a meeting between the members of the group.
We meet, we go to schools, we interview teachers, we meet students. So it's trying to get enough rich data in order to build up a case study of what's happening in two particular universities. The Jesuit-led Université de Saint-Joseph, which is a French-speaking university, and the American University in Beirut, which is an English-speaking university.
And the second project, Education for Global Development. What about that one?
Right. This one is another EU-funded project. It's an Erasmus Plus project led by the Autonomous University of Barcelona. It is to develop and to offer, actually, an international master's, a joint master's, between four campuses: Malta, Barcelona, of course, there is Oslo, and there is Amsterdam. So we will be offering a master's to which already 210 students have applied from all over the world. We have 2 million euros for this project, which basically constitutes 42 full-scale scholarships. We pay for everything. The European Union pays for their student mobility, staff mobility, for their accommodation costs in four different campuses. It's a fascinating and really, really great opportunity for these students. So we have students from Vietnam applying, from Africa, from South America. These will come together as a group of 25. We're in the process of selecting students, and we'll start offering the study units on the different campuses.
And will the students move between
They
the
will
campuses?
Move to each campus every 3 months, and they will come to Malta in June of next year. And the focus of all this is it's targeting those who wish to work in education in developing countries. So we do a lot about globalization, we do a lot about the international agendas for education and what these mean. We do a lot of analysis of policy texts. We tear apart some of these to show what the economic agendas are behind them. We look at all this through the lens of the interaction between global north and the global south. And we also give them skills in implementing projects, in designing projects and implementing them. It consists also of a very long internship in an agency like Save the Children or UNICEF or whatever. And
sounds like a wonderful opportunity.
It is an incredible opportunity. I wish I was young enough to follow this course myself. But this is where European money matters. This is where it can be turned into something that is worthwhile, I think. And it's really very exciting to be part of this. I learn a lot from my colleagues, and I will also learn a lot from the students we'll get from all parts of the world.
Going back a bit to the EMCER.
Right.
We talk a lot about centers of excellence you know, that we want to be in the hub and we're in a good place in the middle of the Mediterranean. I mean, how much of that is true, really? How do you see Malta and your particular center in this case as being a key element in this kind of development of comparative research, right. educational research.
Obviously, without exaggerating our importance, which we tend to do being such a small island, but we do have a role to play. It is significant that we have managed to create a space, a virtual space in a way, where different groups from around the Mediterranean region feel at home in. And we are well placed for this. I mean, as I was saying, the fact that I'm Maltese does help a great deal when I go to Arab states. I feel equally at home in Italy, in France, in Greece, in Spain. And I feel equally at home in a number of Scandinavian countries. So we are, perhaps without actually designing ourselves to be this way, we are very cosmopolitan. We fit in well both in developed and developing contexts, many of us. And somehow it works. I mean, it does work. I mean, we've just published our 8th book in a series with people from all over the Mediterranean contributing. So we have found a niche and we have filled it, I think, with some grace, with some effort, with some beneficial effects. And I see a future for this. And I think, you know, the masters that we've developed, the books we've published, the conferences we have, all these seem to be, in their own small way, contributing to dialogue in our region.
This island seems to have this non-threatening Absolutely. Approach very, very much for
the fact that we have been colonized, for example, that we are not a colonizer. This makes a huge difference. Nobody says these things because it's awkward, but you feel it, actually, when you go to countries and you say, you're from Malta, you're absolutely non-threatening, and there's a good basis for a conversation, an authentic conversation to be had. And I find that, you know, being Maltese helps.
Well, come to the end of the program. Thank you very, very much, Professor Ronald Sultana, for coming to talk to us today about your Euro-Mediterranean Centre for Educational Research and its projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patricia.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.